Today's program was brought to you by Fiji Water and Patina Events at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, an idyllic location for weddings, corporate events, and parties of any style. Visit us at patinaevents.com.
Ever heard of a popcorn-driven robot? This week on Meat and Three, we're bringing you stories about the intersection of food and tech.
We're interested in building swarms of many cheap, small robots and powering them and driving them forward with as little effort and as little energy as possible.
We cover tech by land.
Imagine if you could cut fresh microgreens onto your salad and eat it while the greens are still fresh and nutritious and delicious and alive. That dream is real.
We cover tech by sea.
We're building software-based business services to help shellfish growers manage and grow their business.
And we cover tech in the social media stratosphere.
So it's not really necessarily an indictment on food media or media consumption at all. It's how the robots decided that they were going to weight human interaction.
Tune in and get techie this week on Meat and Three, available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, and welcome to A Hungry Society. I'm Korsha Wilson, and this is the show where we talk about food, food media, and so much more. Today's guest is Ayanna Pressley, policymaker, activist, and the first ever woman of color to be elected to Boston City Council. Ayanna is currently running for a Democratic nomination for Massachusetts' 7th Congressional District. In addition to her advocacy work for communities of color during her eight-year tenure as part of Boston City Council, she successfully pushed for the creation of 75 new liquor licenses, 80% dedicated to disenfranchised neighborhoods, resulting in the creation of dozens of new restaurants and hundreds of jobs. Ayanna was named one of the New York Times' 14 Young Democrats to Watch and one of Boston Magazine's 50 Most Powerful People. She lives in Dorchester, Massachusetts, with her husband, stepdaughter, and her cat named Sojourner Truth, which is just about the best cat name I think I've ever heard. Ayanna, welcome to Hungry Society.
Thank you for having me.
So you were my first ever policymaker that I've ever had on the show. And I really wanted to have you on the show because you have been so connected to restaurants during your time as part of Boston City Council. And it was during the time that I worked in restaurants too, and you did so much up there.
Wow. Well, I'm honored and grateful for your leadership and your providing a platform to talk about the intersectionality of economic and food justice.
Awesome. So I kind of mentioned it in the intro, but can you talk a little bit about Boston Main Streets and the work that you did with that program?
Sure. So I'm a candidate for the Democratic nomination for the 7th Congressional District. I'm also a sitting five-term at-large Boston City Councilor, and I view every issue through a lens of health and equity. And in traversing the city of Boston, going to various neighborhood and civic meetings and just general comings and goings, I saw a stark contrast in our main streets. And I wanted to better understand why there were some main streets that had vitality and vibrancy and foot traffic and other main streets that did not. And it seemed to me the connective tissue for those thriving main streets was that they had walkable amenities in the form of sit-down restaurants. And so I wanted to take this issue on and ensure that every neighborhood would have an equity and opportunity to build community and to build wealth, which is what I see the role of neighborhood restaurants playing. And I worked with the city council, two mayors, and the state legislature to reform a 100-year-old law, which was creating over time, or which did over time, create a two-tiered food system. So you had neighborhoods like the North End, the Back Bay, the South End, downtown neighborhoods that enjoyed a density, even a saturation of sit-down restaurants, and residents were saying, we don't want any more. And then neighborhoods like Roxbury, Mattapan, and Dorchester and Hyde Park, which had not seen a new sit-down restaurant for 10, 15, 20 years. So working with aspiring restaurateurs, existing restaurateurs, and my colleagues in government, we reformed the law. The city now has control of the licensing board. And we were able to onboard 75 new licenses, eliminating a black market. Full alcohol licenses used to go for $250,000, beer and wine for $35,000 to $55,000. And due to lending disparities, certainly that was cost prohibitive for people to procure a license or to open a new restaurant. And so, as you mentioned in your lead-in, 75% of the licenses we created have been restricted to neighborhoods historically disenfranchised and underserved. And that's wealth building in perpetuity. Those licenses cannot leave the community. So I'm encouraged by our progress, but not yet satisfied. I still have an appetite, pun intended, for reform and change. And so that's some of the work that I'm doing now on the council. But it's the work that I also hope to do if I'm fortunate enough to be elected to the 7th Congressional District to make sure that every municipality, every neighborhood, every community has an equity and opportunity to build community and to build wealth. And the last thing I would say is the other reason I'm passionate about this industry. I mean, I like to eat. I didn't just get these hips from my mother. But also because the restaurant industry is the path of least resistance. This is one of the industries that has emerged as an informal economy, as a path of wealth building and entrepreneurialism and small business ownership for women and immigrants and people of color when there have been so many other industries we've been locked out of. But also it's the path of least resistance for people who experience barriers to employment, immigrants, people with criminal records.
Absolutely. And I remember hearing you speak about this a few years ago, and you used this great phrase of, you know, restaurants are where we all break bread together, and saying that you wanted to see more of that in Boston, and that's why you were pursuing, you know, creating more equity with these liquor licenses.
Absolutely. Boston is an incredibly diverse city, but also an incredibly segregated one. And oftentimes, the only time you see truly the representation and the diversity of the city is at a restaurant. And so, you know, I want for Boston what I grew up with in Chicago, which is a culinary scene that is reflective of the racial and cultural diversity of the city. I do believe in the power of food and the power of fellowship to build community and even to build movements.
Right. And speaking of the power of food, you also did a program with Boston Public Schools with to bring more culturally diverse foods into the school system. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I do believe there are many barriers to children learning, and hunger is certainly one of them. And although we've made great strides to destigmatize free lunch, the quality of the food left much to be desired. The kids were usually wasting the food and throwing it out. It was, at its worst, airplane sort of prepackaged food because it was outsourced. And so I advocated for us to pick a vendor that would be based upon something other than just the lowest bid, but who would prioritize providing fresh and healthy food, who would support and empower students in that they are the consumers of the food and allow them to inform the menu choices. And then also, how could we make sure the food would be culturally relevant and then palatable? So it needed to taste good, it needed to be culturally relevant, and it needed to be fresh and healthy. And so we worked for 3 years, and we were able to onboard a new vendor. We're making great strides, but again, I'm encouraged but not yet satisfied. I still have an appetite, pun intended, for change. And what I'd like to see is our schools ultimately to get to a model of farm to school. Both to inform healthier habits, to ensure that students have a readiness to learn because they're getting food that supports their cognitive development, that is nutrient dense, and keeps them full. We know for so many young people, their only opportunity to receive a full and balanced meal is at school. So, and as a way to address health disparities, we need to make sure that we're providing that education as soon as possible about healthier habits.
Yeah, I love what you said about farm to school. So I think that's such a beautiful connection. I think that that would be such a great way to address so many different issues.
And create jobs.
Right. It's in the community. And I think communities have more solutions than we think.
I agree. For every issue that I've worked on, if I wanted to know how to better support cyclists or artists or grieving family members who've lost loved ones to gun violence or restaurateurs or tradesmen and women, I went and spent time, or immigrants. I mean, I could go on. I do believe that the people closest to the pain, however you define that pain, should be the closest to the power, driving and informing the policy making. I never ran for office because I have all the solutions. I ran because I was committed to working with community to develop the best ones. And for every legislative victory I've realized, it's been because I went and spent time with the impacted community and said, how do we chart a new path together? And the same has certainly been true around food justice issues.
So going back to Main Streets, what are some of the changes that you've seen, come about because of this trying to make things more equitable and, awarding liquor licenses to communities that are historically disenfranchised?
Well, I see a number of existing restaurants that were struggling to be competitive for a number of years. Their bottom line is improved by 30 to 40%. The restaurant industry is a really tough one. I mean, I think we've eliminated a critical cost prohibitive barrier by making licenses more affordable and available. But you've got to have a proven market, a skilled workforce, a sound business plan. So there are a lot of things that go into a successful restaurant, and only 1 in 10 of them survive. So we had a lot of restaurants that were floundering, and now that they have a license, their lives are easier. Many of them have been able to change their models from more of a club model to a family-friendly style model. And then we've seen restaurants open. In my home neighborhood of Dorchester alone, 17 new restaurants over the last 3 years. It's been a game changer. And I think it's not only enriched quality of life for people who live in the neighborhoods who've benefited from these licenses, but it has also incentivized foot traffic, economic growth, and development into these neighborhoods. If you build it, they will come.
So what is the ultimate goal? What do you want to see, the future of Main Streets look like? Is it to add more and more licenses? Is it more and more restaurants opening in neighborhoods? Or what is the future look like for this program?
Well, I've got legislation that I'm in working session right now to finalize, to bring for a vote before the city council so that we can then get it up to the state house and continue on our further iterations of liquor license reform. I think we've proven with the 75 licenses that we did create that there is still a demand and that the market can handle it. And in fact, the market is demanding more, particularly since our population is going to grow by an additional 100,000 people by the year 2030. It is really important that our amenities are keeping pace with the growth of our population. So, again, we don't want to have a density and a saturation that chokes at quality of life. So you have to be mindful of unintended consequences. But I do want every neighborhood to have an equity and opportunity to build community and to build wealth. And I'll just give an example. Recently, my husband celebrated his 41st birthday. And, we're in the middle of this campaign. And honestly, even if we weren't, we still work, long hours. My husband's in government as well. And, normally I would have made reservations at a restaurant on the waterfront or on Newbury Street or, in some other city, wanting to, give him a different experience in a new restaurant, maybe some white linen tablecloths and that sort of thing. And we were able to get in our car and drive 4 minutes to a restaurant that is opened in our neighborhood called The Industry. And it has beautiful linen and beautiful, you know, leather-backed booths and gorgeous ambiance and a great kids menu. In fact, kids eat for free under the age of 12. you know, the windows of the restaurant open out onto the street. And it was just great, you know. So this is about people being able to walk somewhere or drive somewhere quickly and to celebrate life's moments, a graduation, a birthday, an anniversary, and not have to leave their neighborhood to do it, to spend their dollar locally. And again, it just completely enriches general quality of life. So that was a gift, you know. Why leave our neighborhood when we could stay in our neighborhood, you know? So right. This is my husband and I, when he proposed to me, a non-negotiable was that we would have to have date night every Friday. And sometimes that literally just means, you know, watching Netflix and going asleep. Or binge watching Power. That's one of our favorite shows. I don't know if you're down with the Stars Network, but we like it. But the point is, you know, now we have a plethora of new options for our date nights on Friday. So we love that we can just go someplace in our own neighborhood, or we can go someplace else. So encouraged by our progress, more work to be done, and I'm getting to it.
And like you said, it's not just the quality of life, but also it's creating jobs for people in the community as well. And you talked about how the restaurant industry is a catch-all for people from all sorts of backgrounds, including immigrants and women and people of color. And so you're helping to create jobs for them as well, that they can support their families and give to the community as well.
And I'm working at this on every issue, you know, supporting culinary arts training programs so that particularly for incarcerated men and women, there's a lot of training happening behind the wall in the culinary arts, but then to make sure they have a pipeline into additional training and to job placement when they come out. And then within our high schools, supporting the preservation of existing culinary arts programs and the growth of them, because hospitality is quickly emerging as the fourth biggest industry here in Massachusetts. And so it is possible to have a viable career path. One of the things I love about restaurants is the opportunity for upward mobility. 3 out of 5 people, their first job was in a restaurant. And 2 out of 4 restaurants are owned by someone that started working at the front or the back of the house. So there are very few industries for which you can say that.
That's wonderful. I mean, my first job was in a restaurant, so that hits very close to home for me.
Well, I'll also add that so many people in electoral politics and public service come from customer service backgrounds. And I think my experience as a hotel worker is certainly the experience I draw the most from every day. You learn how to take direction quickly, to maintain your calm, even when people are being rude. You know, and, yes. you build community, you know, with your fellow, you know, wait staff. So just very passionate in general about the restaurant and hospitality industry.
Wonderful. So we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back with more with Ayanna Presley.
Patina Restaurant Group offers unparalleled service in New York's most iconic locations, including Lincoln Center, Rockefeller Center, and Macy's Herald Square. From meetings and presentations in the glass-walled atrium to galas in the renovated Palm House and intimate wedding showers at Yellow Magnolia Cafe, your event will be perfectly imagined and customized at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. You can also enjoy a la carte brunch and lunch at the picturesque Yellow Magnolia Cafe overlooking Lily Pool Terrace. Chef Rob Newton and chef de cuisine Morgan Jarrett offer warm, distinctive cuisine with a focus on local vegetables, grains, and sustainably sourced meats and fish.
Okay, so we are back with Ayanna Presley. And so we're going to switch gears a little bit and talk about, you know, more about what dining means to your life. I'm wondering if you have a favorite restaurant at the moment.
Well,
it's a hard question.
I'll say this. My husband and I are sentimental sorts, and there is a restaurant in our neighborhood called the Ashmont Grill, and it is where we had our first date. And so we go there as often as we can. I love their grilled hot dog because it's Chicago style. I would never eat a boiled hot dog. It is grilled to perfection.
Does it have ketchup on it?
Never. I don't like ketchup. The only condiment that I indulge in is mustard and not honey Dijon, yellow. So it is a perfectly toasted bun, perfectly grilled hot dog, and then also incredible French fries. But
nice.
The other thing is probably my favorite food in the world. I mean, it's cake.
I guess it
doesn't count as a food group, but it's like super important to me. I mean, I have a sweet tooth. This is mortifying, but you know, why not? I'm just going to go for broke. So I actually was severely reprimanded by the Girl Scouts because instead of selling my cookies, I ate them all.
When you were a Girl Scout.
Yes, this happened. a little emotional eating. It started early. And then I do have to admit, I have a couple times ordered a birthday cake, and it was not my birthday. So
nice.
I have quite
just everyday cake.
I have exactly some red velvet, some pound cake. You know, I love cake. But yeah, so no, the Ashmont Grill is certainly one of my favorite restaurants. Now, if you want to know if I knew when was my last day on Earth, what would my last meal be? Do you care about that?
Oh, we're going to get to that.
Okay.
We're going to get to that question.
Okay, all right.
But I want to hear more about this Girl Scout thing. So did you have to pay back the Girl Scouts for all the cookies?
As I recall, my mother had me write a letter of apology. And I'm sure there was some level of additional penance. But, you know, it wasn't that I didn't support the cause. I just... was a glutton.
You were very enthusiastic about the cookies were really good.
I think I probably would have sold a lot of cookies, truthfully.
Yeah.
So
you did the research.
You know,
you knew them the best.
Just revisiting this, I'm feeling tremendous guilt. I think I need to find a Girl Scout and make this up. But yeah. But I will tell you though, I did not eat cookies for years. I just lost any desire for a cookie after all those boxes of cookies that I ate.
That's amazing.
But we should move on. This is very uncongressional. So.
So beyond the cookies, do you have any early memories of dining growing up?
I do. You know, I was, I don't know what folks call it today, but I was a latchkey kid. You know, my mother worked a lot of jobs, was raising me alone, so, you know, couldn't afford childcare, and I was a home alone a lot. And so when my mother would finally return home from a long day at work, I would do my best to muster up something in the kitchen for the both of us, which was usually a Swanson's TV dinner or Stouffer's mac and cheese or chicken pot pie.
Oh, yeah.
I'm
familiar.
I was very, very good at the chicken pot pie. And occasionally also a fried bologna sandwich. I don't know if you know anything about that. So,
yep.
You know, this now in hindsight, I know this food was, you know, awful and not good for us. But I still have memories, you know, of my mother and I with our TV trays sitting there. Eating a TV dinner, you know, watching The Cosby Show or something.
Mm-hmm. Wow. When you said TV dinner, my mind just like flashed back to like the Salisbury steak.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah,
I think that meal had chocolate cake. It did have a little piece of chocolate cake. I remember. But occasionally, you know, especially on the weekends, my mother would cook. She was originally from Cincinnati, and in Cincinnati, they make their chili with spaghetti. And I loved her spaghetti. So if I could have, you know, my mother transitioned 6 years ago, so, you know, I miss her every day. If I could have one meal back and just savor it and take my time, it would be my mother's chili, her Cincinnati-style chili and her cornbread. And in fact, when I moved to Boston, I competed regularly in what is an annual Dorchester tradition, which is a chili cook-off. And I won once and received an honorable mention the second year. Let this be a lesson to your listeners. To keep family recipes, you know, I've stopped competing in the chili cook-off because I never got my mother's recipe. And so I've not tried to make chili again, and I no longer compete in the competition. But it is a wonderful way to pass on family tradition and to, you know, storytell with younger generations in the family. And so I do regret that I don't have the recipe, but I have some incredible memories of our making that chili together.
So your mom, you know, you and your mom ate a lot at home. When do you remember starting to like go out to eat and, you know, like developing your love of restaurants that you have?
Mostly Sundays. I think a lot about our going to church and then after church going somewhere for brunch, or maybe for ice cream. My mother loved ice cream. I'm the cake person. She was the ice cream person. So
we would a good match.
Yeah, so we would often go to like this Baskin Robbins, does that still exist? And get like a clown cone. It was like an ice cream cone that, anyway, they decorate like a clown. Anyway, but I remember going to a lot of soul food eateries. The names of them escape me right now. There's also a barbecue place that we used to frequent called Leon's. And then there was a franchise we loved. My mother would allow me to have a Shirley Temple and then a big meal. And that was at a restaurant called Hamburger Hamlet. So we did do our, you know, our fair share of eating outside of the home. And that was usually on Sundays after church.
Same. My grandmother and my aunt, I'd go to church with them, and then, you know, we'd hit the TGI Fridays or the buffet restaurant after church, and it was like a tradition. I feel like a lot of families have that.
I love that you just named Fridays. When I was in high school, I remember one day walking down Michigan Avenue, and it was a Friday, and seeing all these professional people with attaché cases and, you know, Natalie attired in their crisp suits going into TGIFs, and I said, one day, you know, one day I'll be going there too.
When I make it,
I'll be at Fridays for happy hour. It just seemed like
I'll have a dollar margarita. And exactly. I know that I've made it.
Exactly. Now I know better.
That's great. So what do you think of Boston's dining culture? I know that, you know, I lived there for 9 years, and I feel like the restaurant scene there has just expanded and grown so much.
You're
I'm
welcome.
What you make of that. Yes, that's thanks in part to you. But what do you make of it?
Again, I don't think you can be a world-class city without a world-class dining scene. And it's really important that that dining scene be reflective of the diversity of cultures. I mean, one of the reasons why people love the restaurant scene in the South End, I think, is for that reason. The other thing I think we've proven is that restaurants don't cannibalize one another. So it is possible on one block to have a place that you love for their Ethiopian food, and another place that you love for their cocktails, and another place that you love for their dessert. I mean, so I love the idea of restaurant clusters, incentivizing foot traffic into a neighborhood, supporting quality of life for people that live in that neighborhood. And, you know, you're having the opportunity simply to restaurant hop. And so certainly I think the growth of the dining scene has proven that and supported that. I would say one of the things I find frustrating, however, is that most restaurants shut down their kitchen at 10 o'clock at night. And so if you want to have something to eat after 10 o'clock at night and you don't want to enjoy the fine culinary offerings of 7-Eleven, it seems your only option is to go to IHOP. So that is incredibly problematic. A world-class city doesn't shut down. So you have to have transit that supports that restaurant and hospitality scene, a workforce that supports that, and you need to be open later, I think. Especially when you think about like startup culture and the gig economy and things like that, you know, people just are not ordering their steps in a very traditional 9-to-5 way.
Right. Yeah, I remember many nights of getting out of work late, and it's like, okay, well, there's not really anywhere to eat, except for there's a 24-hour grocery store near Prudential that you could go and like buy stuff, but who wants to like cook at 1 a.m.?
Actually, shout out to Victoria Diner. I do love diners, and they are open very late, and they do have one of our liquor licenses, so I do appreciate a good traditional diner experience. A bottomless black cup of coffee, huge portions, you know, economical. And I do have to say that breakfast is my favorite meal. I could eat breakfast all day, and I do make incredible pancakes. And not just my 10-year-old says so. I do make a good pancake.
Nice. So we've talked about some of your favorites. What was your like least favorite dining experience? And you can name the restaurant if you want to. You don't have to, but you can. Can you talk about one of your least favorite dining experiences?
In full transparency, this is probably dangerous. When my friends and I were asked to pay for our food before our food came.
In a restaurant?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. At a franchise restaurant at IHOP, actually. And
wow.
They had no idea that, and it shouldn't have mattered, but who actually was dining with me was the executive director of the Mass Black and Latino Legislative Caucus, the president of the Boston branch of the NAACP, and then myself, and we were just coming from a New Hampshire debate in support of Elizabeth Warren, who was a candidate for Senate at the time. And the debate ended late, and we decided to stop and get something to eat. And we placed our order, and they asked for us to render payment before they would bring our food, because they said people had been walking out on their bill.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was...
I felt the air quotes on that, people. There's air quotes around that.
Yeah, so that was, you know, the worst experience. What else could I...
Wow, that's terrible.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. But I don't have an experience that immediately comes to mind where I would say, and the food was just awful, and the service was, you know, terrible. In general, because I did work in the hotel industry, I'm usually... Yeah, I think about when I was single and how I would judge someone I went out on a date with based on how they treated, the wait staff in a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And so I'm probably the last person that would ever be critical of my experience as a customer, just because I know what it is to be on the other side and how impatient people can be and unreasonable. So,
Wow. So, Ayana, if you could have your last meal in a restaurant, where would it be and who is invited?
Oh, this is tough because my last meal would either... It's just tough because I love salmon, and I love salmon in any form, and I never tire of having salmon with some, you know, awesomely grilled asparagus and maybe some, you know, steak frites, fries, those little skinny, you know... So I think it would be truffle fries, like little skinny truffle fries, salmon, Atlantic salmon, grilled, but crisp at the top, very important. And then grilled asparagus with a little bit of olive oil, little lemon juice.
This is very specific.
I'm sorry, I'm hungry. and probably some hot rolls Can we just give it up to hot rolls? I cannot stand when people bring me a bread basket and the bread is not warm. That is, you know, the crescendo of the experience, I think. So I don't know what restaurant...
Yeah, it's a buzzkill when it's cold. Yeah. And you can't spread the butter.
You can't
on
spread
it,
the butter. Thank you. So I don't know where I would have that meal, but I feel badly because I do so much work in the restaurant space and I should be giving, you know, bigger shout outs to the local economy here. But I know what the meal would be. I just don't know exactly, you know, where I would have it. And who would I want to be a part of that? I'm going to be very selfish and say my husband, my daughter, and if I can bring someone from the other side, obviously my mother, and Shirley Chisholm.
And Shirley Chisholm. That's a great table of people.
I know.
What are you having for dessert?
You know, it depends. I don't know. Maybe I'd be good, you know, go for a little angel food cake or something. But if I was going to be completely decadent, I would go for old school chocolate lava cake and enough spoons for everyone to get a bite. Chocolate lava cake with a little bit of vanilla bean ice cream. Perfection.
Nice. That I feel like the chocolate lava cake is underrated. It's still a good dessert.
It is underrated, but you know what is overrated? Flourless chocolate cake. Please stop making that. Whoever is doing that, please stop. It is dense. It is not enjoyable. Also, I do need to just say that. You know that trend where they had the mini donuts that everyone was doing? I couldn't stand those donuts. People kept burning them. Please cease and desist with these tiny donuts and flourless chocolate cake. No one is ordering it anymore.
You should add that to like your campaign stump is please no more flourless chocolate cakes and no more mini donuts.
No more mini donuts. They're off trend.
On the ballot, no more flourless chocolate cakes. I'd vote for it.
Yeah. Oh, but you know what, though? The one question you didn't ask me, given all my work on liquor license reform, would you like to know what my libation of choice is?
Yes. I was going to ask what you were going to drink with this meal.
Okay. Scotch.
Okay.
Yeah, scotch.
A on the rocks. Particular brand or
beautifully weighted. No, Macallan. 18.
Ooh.
Yeah. So, but if that weren't my last meal and my last cocktail, then I'd probably go for either an espresso martini or a Moscow Mule. Those are two of my go-tos.
Okay.
On date night, which is usually the only time I have a cocktail. So every Friday with my beloved.
I say have it all. Just, it's your last meal. You might as well have whatever you want.
Yes. Yes. What would your last meal be?
Oh.
See that turning the tables on you, the proverbial dining table on you.
It would be mostly seafood. Probably like grilled, like, you know, a nice whole fish, some lobsters, some shrimp, some crab. Have to have crab because I grew up in Maryland.
I was about to say that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
If you grew up in Maryland, then you definitely grew up getting some quality seafood, but occasionally tell the truth, you did go to Red Lobster and you love those cheddar biscuits.
Wow. Okay. You don't need to, you know, tell my life story.
I know Maryland. Right. I know Maryland. I did live and work in DC for 7 years. So,
you know, those Red Lobsters get very busy in Maryland.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, Ayana, you are welcome on the show anytime. I always enjoy hearing you speak, and especially when it comes to restaurants and food. Thank you so much for your time.
I'm grateful for your having created this platform. I think, you know, the issue of food and the role that it plays in community does not get enough oxygen. So thank you for creating a space and for it to get the love and the attention that it deserves. And we'll see you soon. And I hope we can actually have a meal together and break bread sometime. That would be awesome.
I have to bring a box of Girl Scout cookies.
Oh my goodness. I can tell I'm going to regret having shared this story. This is a testament to you. It means that you're a great journalist because you made me feel so comfortable that I went into just full unfiltered confessional mode. So,
right. I got the scoop.
Yeah. All right then. Have a great day.
Well, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.